This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Bruce Herbert, Chief Executive of Newground Social Investment, a social purpose corporation dedicated to socially responsible investing and shareholder advocacy. Bruce was most recently a guest on the sustainability segment in June of 2014, when he told us about recent successes of shareholder advocacy in creating positive change in publicly traded corporations. Bruce Herbert is here today to give us an update on progress made since then and to evaluate the accomplishments of shareholder engagement in this year's 2015 proxy season. Welcome, Bruce.
Thank you. It's good to be back together.
Would you remind us, what is socially responsible investing?
I suppose in simple terms, socially responsible investing, also known as ESG investing, which stands for environment, social, and governance issues, is a way of people joining their values or expressing their values through their dollars and their investments. It has often been described as a three-legged stool. And the first leg is screening, and that's avoiding companies that are engaged in activities that you don't agree with. The second leg is community investment or microcredit lending, often today called impact investing. And that is making capital access and banking services available to groups of people who have traditionally been underserved, if not outright excluded. That would include minority people, people of color, women, geographic regions of the world, or even of a town. We've heard of redlining in certain areas in town. And the third leg of the three-leg stool of social investment is shareholder advocacy or shareholder activism, shareholder engagement, which in contrast to screening, which is selling your shares and walking away from the company, is using your shares, using your ownership rights of a shareholder to actively engage with companies about transforming their behaviors and activities that you find disagreeable.
How widespread is socially responsible investing and who is involved?
Oh, my word, it has grown significantly. Since we last talked, the Social Investment Forum has released what they call their Trends Report. It comes out every 2 years. And it came out in September of last year. And social investment, the assets invested in this way, have grown 76% since 2 years prior. So it's now at $6.57 trillion. That's roughly one in every $6 that's invested. Now, dollars invested is not dollar bills in your wallet. It's money like in mutual funds or in investment accounts, brokerages, IRAs, pension funds, things like that. So it is different from the money supply, but it's a phenomenal increase and a phenomenal recognition of two or three things at least. One is the growing awareness of people that we live in a culture that's mediated by money. And so using our money in a way that serves the larger purpose is valuable. I think it's also a very strong endorsement of the long-term realization that you don't give up returns to invest socially. That old Wall Street myth that if you want to do good, you have to do good by the environment or social issues. You have to do bad by your investment returns. And that is just not true. And in terms of the people, there are a wide array of groups and individuals. There are, of course, many individuals who invest socially, but there are public funds, your state and municipal pension funds, religious investors, labor funds, foundations and endowments, all of the nonprofit money, money managers and mutual funds. It's a phenomenal array of individuals and institutions that now are carrying the banner and making a real difference.
Would you say more about the role that shareholder advocacy plays in socially responsible investing?
I think to put it into context, people are very familiar with the environmental axiom, reduce, reuse, recycle. And many people sort of innately think that those are equivalent choices, but they really are not. They form more of a hierarchy where recycling is a point of entry, it's necessary, but it's really not at all sufficient to achieve our greater goals. And the reducing and reusing are much more beneficial to the larger environment. In a similar way, the three elements of social investment, the screening, the community investment or impact, and shareholder engagement also form a hierarchy, where screening is the starting point. It is necessary, but it's not sufficient. It is historically where the movement started back in the 1920s. But in terms of impact and transformative beneficial outcomes on the ground, the community investment and the shareholder engagement really have much more positive clout.
Shareholder proposals are used within the shareholder advocacy efforts. What determines whether a shareholder proposal is placed on the ballot at an annual meeting?
Well, there are two or three different levels there, Diane. The rules around all this are promulgated by the Securities and Exchange Commission that was authorized under the Exchange Act of 1934. The rules are actually both simple and complex. The most straightforward set of rules that establish whether a shareholder can put a proposal into a proxy for a vote of all shareholders is simply if they own $2,000 worth of stock and have held those shares for at least a year. Well, logistically, that's pretty straightforward. There's a difference between the logistical ease versus the practical reality. Because if you put forward a shareholder's proposal, and this gets into the second phase, companies have the right to challenge the existence of a proposal and try to strike it from the proxy, have it be excluded by citing all array of other elements of the SEC rules. And that challenge process will often end up in a quasi-legal proceeding where you're getting dossiers that are half-inch thick and pretty dense to wade through. So the individual investor, unfortunately, often gets kind of washed out of the game unless they have allied themselves with some group or organization or money manager or fund that knows how to do that and makes it work on their behalf.
How active has this year's proxy season been in terms of shareholder proposals being submitted?
It actually is the most active year on record. We had 445 proposals submitted this year, which is the largest number of social and environmental proposals ever. And I should say that that does focus on those categories. There's a whole other area of engagement, which is governance. And many governance proposals are put in by socially concerned investors, but those strictly aren't included in this number, but it is a very large number and it's growing and shows the increasing use of this tool to really try to transform behavior on the ground.
Would you give some highlights of the 2015 proxy season?
There's lots to choose from. Of course, climate resolutions dealing with a variety of different aspects of climate change. Something called proxy access is very important and has seen a significant new surge this year. And what that means, that's shorthand for allowing shareholders access to nominating directors for potential election onto the company board. Of course, political spending and lobbying is the largest number of shareholder proposals of that 445. Sustainability reporting, a variety of human rights issues have arisen. So there's a phenomenal variety.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Bruce Herbert, Chief Executive of Newground Social Investment. Our topic is shareholder advocacy and progress made toward creating positive change in publicly traded corporations during the 2015 proxy season. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. Would you speak about challenges to the process of shareholder advocacy that have come up this year?
Well, this year has seen some quite significant challenges that we're right in the midst of as we speak. Back in the 1970s, there were some issues around voting on shareholder proposals that the SEC put in a rule that talked about shareholders not being able to submit a quote-unquote conflicting proposal, and i.e. conflicting with a management-sponsored one. And that had to do mainly with mergers and acquisitions. If something was announced and then a shareholder could try to circumvent the proxy voting rules and solicitation rules by submitting their own shareholder proposal. So Rule 14A8, subcase I-9, said that these could be excluded under those terms. It was very narrowly drawn. But in the last couple of years, this year in particular, companies and their lawyers have seized upon this exclusionary rule and have tried to broaden it phenomenally beyond its original intent, so as to say that any proposal that a shareholder puts forward, that if a management also puts forward a proposal in the same realm, whether or not it's legally binding, whether or not it's actually conflicting or not, even if it's on just sort of generally the same subject matter, the company, according to how the law firms would like this to be interpreted, could just outright exclude the shareholder proposal. That has the potential of allowing any shareholder proposal that's sponsored for the company to see that, and they don't even have to put forward their actual proposal. All they have to do is say that they are thinking of putting a proposal in, and then they can strike the shareholder one. So that has been very much at the front of our minds. We are actually right in the last days of getting a sign on. We have about 80 institutions right now signing on in a number of states and a number of large pension funds. CalPERS, the largest pension fund in America, writing to say that this is an inappropriate use of this rule. This rule should be interpreted in terms of its original intent, which was very narrow, very specific, and useful in those terms, but not to give companies carte blanche. So that's one of the main things that's been happening in terms of shareholder advocacy this year, and it's still a stay tuned.
What are the implications if this goes through?
Well, simply that, broadly interpreted, any shareholder-sponsored proposal on any topic could be stricken from the proxy, and shareholders wouldn't even know that the topic was being addressed and certainly wouldn't receive any attention. And what's important about that is, one thing that's very important about it, is this is the major way for shareholders of all stripes, both large and small, to communicate with the boards of directors that have the legal mandate to serve shareholder interest in their capacities on those boards at these companies. And so it wipes away the major channel of communication. So valuable, important information that gives boards insights into how their owners want the companies run or think they should be considering is just taken away. It really is a travesty for corporate governance as a whole and a real blow to the rights and sovereignty and shareholder democracy.
New ground has brought the issue of how votes at shareholder meetings are counted to the forefront. What is the problem surrounding vote counting at shareholder meetings?
Well, Diane, you and I are sitting down, and I hope your listeners are too, because you will be shocked to understand that there's actual vote manipulation happening in corporate America. And I say vote manipulation lightly. It is all legal. Just in our view, it's highly inappropriate. And basically what it means is that companies can choose to count votes in a variety of different ways. And the formula that one uses can change the outcome significantly. A local company, Fortune 500 company that Newground put forward a proposal at a few years ago, just the short story is we got a 56.2% outcome if you count what's called a simple majority, just the people who voted for and against, kind of the way our democratic elections are handled. But by adding other categories of vote, abstentions and what they're called broker non-votes, people who didn't even return the ballot, if you add those categories into the formula, as the company did at that time, it changed the outcome from 56.2 to 5.8, a more than 50% swing in the outcome. Now that is just, to me, outrageous. And so we have started a campaign and have gone to a number of companies asking them to change their corporate documents and bylaws to adopt a simple majority vote counting standard across the board to be fair, democratic, and transparent. It's a very straightforward ask. A large number of institutions have gotten on board with this, and CalPERS, again, the largest pension fund in America, they did a very interesting and worthwhile study in 2013 that showed that of the 1,000 largest companies in the S&P 500 and Russell 1000, that 52% count using these variant approaches that automatically depress the vote. 48% count in a simple majority. So we've gone to companies asking them to adopt a simple majority across the board, and a third of companies approached so far have done so. And so we're really ramping this up and rolling it out. A large number of institutions have filed and co-filed with us, so this year it's going to be even larger. We also actually are going to the New York Stock Exchange and asking, we're going to be, this is in the plans for the upcoming year and a half, asking them to adopt listing requirements so that a company, in order to be listed on the New York Stock Exchange, would have to count votes in this fair and transparent manner. We're going to the signatories of the Carbon Disclosure Project, trillions of dollars of assets, and asking them to request this of their signatory companies. The UNPRI, the Principles on Responsible Investment, seeking for that to be, again, a listing or membership requirement of UNPRI, so as to put continual pressure from a variety of different perspectives on really what should be an easy thing to put into place.
What steps have been taken in the shareholder advocacy arena this year in regard to climate change?
Well, there were about 76 directly climate change-related proposals. And that doesn't include ones on coal and alternative energy, just ones on climate change, gas emissions, and things like that. What's really interesting, two or three very interesting things this year. more and more of these are going to a vote this year than ever before. Before, there have been relatively similar numbers of proposals filed, but a number of withdrawals. The companies might agree to a report. They might agree to actually take some, frankly, little step, given the size and dimension of these companies. But more and more have gone to votes in this year. And what we don't know yet why, it's being studied, whether the requests are actually more difficult and challenging, harder for companies to implement, whether companies are just being more recalcitrant and deciding, you know, it's sort of like the low-hanging fruit. Companies that are kind of better than average might have already taken the steps requested. And so now what we have left are filings at companies that are, you know, more entrenched. Perhaps the proponents, the shareholders putting forward, are a little bit more angry or feeling a greater sense of urgency and aren't as willing to settle for partial measures, which, you know, in the past have been deemed to kind of be moving the ball forward. It's hard to say. But those are some of the things that have been going on. Basically, the bottom line is more votes and fewer withdrawals. One could go on and on about this topic. It's really one of the key focal points of shareholder engagement over the last half decade at least, and naturally will continue to be so. And now, of course, we also have the dimension of the divestment campaign, the 350.org request.
Would you say more about the divestment effort?
In regards to divestment, there are a couple of elements that really are important for people to understand in terms of the context, both historically and its implications for actions today. Historically, of course, divestment, most people talk about the South African divestiture movement, which had two parts. One was divestment, selling shares of companies, but the other part was looking at companies that are doing business in South Africa and saying to them, if you're doing business in South Africa, we're not going to do business with you. And that actually caused those companies to make a choice. Were they going to maintain their smaller operations and sales, et cetera, in South Africa, or were they going to favor their larger, much more robust and important markets in the United States? So that caused companies to pull out of South Africa. That is what then dried up the money and funding to the apartheid regime. And every freedom fighter that I have talked to or heard on record has said that that was the key. That was the key to bringing apartheid down. So in today's context, many people don't understand the two elements, and they think that we should only sell companies, divest of companies. But there is a very important role for engagement in trying to get companies to change their activities and behavior. And one of the things that I think is important about that, some have said that, well, we've had decades of work on oil and gas companies with no impact, with no effect. Well, that is both an overstatement and, I think, not understanding of historical reality, at least in the sense that all of the information, disclosures, et cetera, upon which we now are able to make these divestment arguments and decisions is available precisely because of the activities of shareholder advocates like myself, like others who have been in this tradition for decade after decade. And the basis upon which we can now make these arguments is there, the information is there because of what we did in past years. So the complexity of this topic requires a variety of different approaches and us working together and all coming at it from inside and outside and every way around. It's not served by us fighting among ourselves and saying, oh, this is right and that shouldn't be done and so on and so forth. It really needs us all to come together. And that is the main thing to say about divestment. I could add that the main request of 350.org, when that request is being considered, is to divest of what's called the Carbon Underground or the Carbon Tracker 200. Now, those are the 200 companies that have the largest unextracted reserves of carbon-based assets underground. So what's interesting about that is a portfolio can be fully divested in accord with the 350.org request and not have any of the Carbon Tracker 200, but they could still have companies like Halliburton in it, because Halliburton doesn't own assets under the ground. They're not an extraction company. They're an oil and gas service company. And so even when one applies these kinds of screens, which can be done very effectively and without real impact to portfolio performance, even when you do it, you still will end up with some companies that might be shocking to the average investor. So it's a complex topic and worthy of an entire conversation, but that's a flavor of it. Of course, locally, we've had the city of Seattle. Their pension fund, their retirement system, has been asked to divest. It went through a lengthy proceeding that I actually was asked to testify upon several occasions. And they have taken an engagement approach. They might divest of coal. That hasn't been determined yet, but they already have committed to an active role with their holdings, have already joined Ceres, have already joined several organizations, and city representatives have been going to important conferences and learning from much larger and much more seasoned and experienced institutions about how they can do this.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Bruce Herbert, Chief Executive of Newground Social Investment. Our topic is shareholder advocacy and progress made toward creating positive change in publicly traded corporations during the 2015 proxy season. In what ways has shareholder advocacy addressed corporate lobbying and political contributions or spending during this year's proxy season?
That's one of the two key areas of shareholder activity. And 125 resolutions, shareholder proposals, were filed this year that dealt with the two areas. One is the disclosure of spending and political activity, and the other is actual lobbying. Now, the key to disclosure and the request for disclosure is not just political activity in the sense of candidates. It really is much more focused and much more importantly directed toward the disclosure of trade associations and so-called 501c4 organizations, social welfare, quote-unquote, organizations, 527 plans, which is the so-called Swift Vote Veterans for Truth that funded the attack ad against John Kerry, and so forth. This is how money is being laundered into our political process. We talk about dark money, dark pools, basically dark because the light's out in terms of who actually is giving that money. We've been impacted in this state. A state attorney general race, a primary, Deborah Sin, former quite well-known and quite celebrated insurance commissioner, was knocked out of her bid for attorney general because of $2 million, which in this state, in a primary context, was seismically huge amount of money, came in TV attack ads the last 7 days of the campaign. It came from an organization that had one of those innocuous names like Washington's for a Better Tomorrow that had been founded the day before the money was funded to the TV people. And the money came to that organization from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And the lawsuits are still going on today, attempt to disclose who gave that money originally. We still don't know, and this is the process. And so companies, Goldman Sachs has done some great things in terms of, you know, human rights and other types of activities. But in this area, they, shortly after Citizens United came out, for instance, they stood up and said, we pledge not to do any political contributions. Well, that was well and good, but that's not how they would have done it anyway, because direct, true political activity gets reported. And so it was a meaningless comment that sounded good, looked good to the uninitiated, but really it was quite meaningless. And so this is what is really important about these things. And the lobbying proposals actually ask companies not to lobby, to get out of that game entirely. So it's sort of two flavors of the same thing. But there are 125 proposals in total, split about half and half between the lobbying and the political disclosure. About a 28% average vote, which in shareholder terms is quite a good vote, because if you think about the demographics of voting entail that very often a majority of company shares are controlled directly or indirectly by founding families, by management. Even something like an employee stock purchase plan that is for the benefit of employees is actually voted by management. And then, of course, the largest number of people don't return their proxies at all. So of the shares that are independent, not controlled, and also informed, actually have read their proxies opposed to just recycling it. So in that context, a 28% average vote is quite nice. And it often gets the attention of companies. And we have more than 150 companies, more than half of the Fortune 100, have actually adopted very thoroughgoing disclosure, including these 501c4s and trade associations and the like. Here in the Northwest, Starbucks has, well, the former Washington Mutual did before they failed, Microsoft, and notably Boeing. We actually were responsible for all four of those companies taking that tack, Investor Voice and Newground Social Investment. But Boeing, it took 6 years. The first year, in a rare moment of candor, the associate treasurer said, we just don't have the stomach for this kind of disclosure. And they went all the way to adopting, well, at the time, the most thoroughgoing set of disclosure policies of any company in America. And they're holding to it. So there are good things happening in that front, and it's worth celebrating for sure.
What do you consider the greatest successes of the 2015 proxy season?
Depends upon how you measure success. And of course, it's not just the votes. We've already talked about that. It's also what companies will agree to do. And fully 60% of shareholder proposals as a whole do get withdrawn because companies have actually agreed to do something. I mean, case in point, Conagra Foods earlier this year adopted the vote counting, changed their governing documents. So there wasn't a shareholder proposal to vote on. In fact, shareholder proponents often feel that a vote is the least desirable outcome. It represents a failure of negotiation if it ends up that way. But certainly proxy access is a very important one. We touched on it earlier, but a major campaign was put forward where 75 companies were addressed by proxy access. Now, this is by the New York State Pension Retirement Systems. That actually led to the backlash in this whole thing of the company lawyers trying to use that 14A8I9 conflict resolution to try and knock them out. But more than 40 of those got a majority vote, over 50%. And seven actually withdrew and agreed to allow proxy access for shareholders. And there's a large number of agreements around that. Companies are setting greenhouse gas emission goals and targets. So those are some of the things that have been very worthwhile, I think, in this past proxy year.
What do you consider the greatest disappointments of the 2015 proxy season?
Oh, the greatest disappointment is always that we have to continue doing this, that companies and society as a whole just doesn't do the right thing, you know, by and large, with automatically. But certainly, as much as there has been positive movement in the climate change arena, companies are not moving far enough or fast enough. That is absolutely clear. We still have tremendous challenge with executive compensation, phenomenal overpayment of executives, and then also representation of minorities and women on boards of directors. I think there's only about 20% of board seats today. In 2015, they were held by women. You know, that's a huge failing, I think, in terms of corporate America. Now, it's not for lack of being asked by shareholder advocates, but it just shows the strength and tenacity of the old boy network.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I always want to offer a message of hope. People often are despairing these days. I see it particularly in the environmental arena, but I think of the suffragettes. Not one of the original suffragettes who was struggling to get the vote in America for women, not one of the original suffragettes lived to see the vote won. And yet, would any of them say that their efforts were useless just because they didn't see? No, they knew that there was something larger, a societal goal that would be good for their daughters and their granddaughters and society and the common good as a whole. So they kept on. So I like to think about the possibility and the message of hope. It is possible to use money in a way that is consistent with our values and beliefs, and you don't need to give up return or believe the Wall Street myth that you have to suffer financially in order to do right socially and environmentally. And the easiest way to do this, I think both from a financial perspective, but also in terms of a keeping one's spirit up perspective, is to do so in community with others. You know, there's that old saying that if you want to go fast, travel alone, but if you want to go far, travel together. So that's the key message, is to travel together with others of like mind in social investment.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Bruce.
Oh, it's terrific, as always. Thank you, Diane.
You were just listening to Bruce Herbert, Chief Executive of Newground Social Investment. For more information, check on the web at newground.net and investorvoice.net. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the Sustainability segment again next week on Listener Powered 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.